When Gordon Grice was 6 years old and living in rural Oklahoma, a cougar wreaked havoc on his grandfather's ranch. That encounter was the start of a lifelong obsession. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Although Grice clearly loves and admires all creatures great and small, he is fascinated by the predators amongst us. In his new book, Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals, he examines the wilder side of all kinds of animals, from nematodes to elephants. For the next hour, we'll talk about the not-so-warm and fuzzy encounters people have had with creatures, including lions, tigers, bears, sharks, and the less frightening ferrets and magpies. We'll talk about what we can learn about animals from those encounters and what we can learn about the human animal. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Gordon Grice, author of Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals. In the book, he focuses on the predatory nature of creatures great and small, and in particular on situations where animals hurt or even kill human beings. Gordon, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And this fascination with the dangerous side of nature started for you when you were about 6 years old. Can you tell me what happened?
We lived on a ranch in rural Oklahoma. And one day, as my mother and my sister and I were returning in the car from a shopping trip or something, my grandfather waved us down on the road and told us that there was a cougar treed in the front yard and that we had to turn around and go away until that problem was solved. And so this was so fascinating to me, partly because I never got to see it. I had to go away. And, of course, it was very dangerous to us. But, you know, as a child, my whole focus was on how exciting that was and how interesting and how frustrating that I didn't get to see more of it.
Right. Even though, I mean, what you learned later on is that a cougar probably wasn't a particular danger to you.
Probably not. Cougar attacks on human beings are very rare. Of course, that, you know, from the perspective of my grandfather, looking at a cougar in the tree above right. where two children played, you know, he had to assume that it was.
But, right. And that was the smart move.
Yeah.
But in your book, you write a lot about these incidents, and they are comparatively rare throughout recent years and throughout history, where animals attack humans and actually kill humans in many events. And in a way, it's a very voyeuristic look. These stories are completely fascinating, but your approach is very respectful. Can you try to explain to me why you're so fascinated with this side of nature, but also the fact that you seem to really love animals and have a respect for them?
To me, it was an area that nobody was talking about, and that made it interesting to talk about. I had sort of grown up on Jane Goodall and Jacques Cousteau and, you know, a very environmental perspective, which I still have. But oftentimes that perspective becomes oversimplified to the point that we lose sight of facts. And so often I encounter people who can't believe that another animal would hurt a human. And I think a writer named Jeffrey Mason put it very well when he said he was amazed to find out that an elephant didn't necessarily love him just because he loved it. So the fact is that each of these animals has its own way of being, its own patterns of behavior, and they don't necessarily like us. They don't necessarily even see us as distinct from other kinds of animals.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the individual kinds of animals. You go through a litany of different kinds of creatures, but you start mm-hmm. you start with canines. Mm-hmm. You start with our relationship with wolves. And again, that's a relationship that these days is pretty civil.
It is in some ways. The starting point for me was looking at what is a wolf, and of course a dog is a wolf, as well as a wild wolf being a wolf. And what I mean by that is that they are the same species. They are all Canis lupus, and there are subspecies within that. But that's significant because we see behavior patterns that are consistent across what seem to us to be very different animals, the dingoes, the coyotes, the wolves, the domestic dogs. And so it's a very complex relationship. It's been said that when we domesticated the dog, he domesticated us. He's essential to our civilization because he made it possible for us to stay in one place because he's so much better at guarding our homesteads than we are. And yet the other side of this is that the dog is by far the large predator that's most likely to attack us. You know, something like 800,000 emergency room visits in the U.S. alone each year caused by dog bite. So it's, you know, an amazingly complicated relationship.
Well, and of course, there are dogs who are more similar to their wolf-like brethren, and then there mm-hmm. are dogs that are significantly less similar. But you write about the dog that you grew up with in childhood who was very in touch with his instincts.
Yeah, this Mr. Peck was his name, this old yellow dog. And he was very much a wild animal in some ways, and this was an education to me to just observe how dogs in general, and particularly this dog, behaved. And the one thing that I wrote about in the book was this incident where he killed a kitten that we had just adopted. And it was traumatic for me. It made me very angry at the dog. But my mother's explanation to me was that he was just being a dog. And so this was the sort of early insight to me into the fact that you can love an animal and yet he can be completely different from you.
Right. And well, and I think one of the important things that people need to remember about their dogs is that their dogs have these instincts. I think a lot of us are shocked when a dog bites someone or a dog kills a rabbit in the backyard or that kind of thing. But because we spend so much time with them, do you think that we lose sight of the fact that they are related to wild animals?
Yeah, I think, project ourselves onto them. We think of them as family members, and so we expect human behavior from them. And of course, that's not what we get.
You write about dingoes, and dingoes are a particularly dangerous wild dog. And I wonder, dingoes, tell me a little bit about their history in Australia, because they were actually, they are not native wild dogs to Australia.
Right. They came over to Australia perhaps over 4,000 years ago with indigenous people. And so they were already domesticated dogs accompanying humans, but once released into the wild there, they formed a wild population. An interesting thing happens with dogs when they go wild again. They begin to become more wolf-like, not just in their behavior, but in their appearance. So they'll even develop the the pointy upright ears, for example, and the longer snouts that we see with wolves. Because those other characteristics, flop ears and short snouts, are domestic traits that we have bred into dogs. The dingoes, a completely what would be called a feral population, not wild, but feral, because they were once tamed. And I would say they're not particularly dangerous wild dogs, but it's been such a problem in Australia the few times they have attacked people, because people think of them as dogs, and they like to feed them, they like to pet them. And so when you find out that a dingo has a lot of wolf in him and that he sometimes will attack people and even kill people, it's a startling occurrence.
Right. And so it's actually the relationship between humans and these dogs that creates the danger.
Yes, and that really is sort of my point in the entire book. It's our relationship with every animal that has dangers in it. It's not that the animal is inherently a bad creature or even inherently a dangerous creature. It's how we relate to them.
Well, and it's very interesting when you write about cougars, which, since that was sort of what set you on this lifetime journey, and then you write about cougars and the fact that for many years, cougar attacks were extremely rare, but in early history, cougars were considered to be very dangerous to human beings. We went through a long period where they were not considered to be dangerous to human beings. But then in recent years, we have seen cougar attacks. And you actually write that maybe it is, in a way, it's our changing and more, I guess, a more responsible, more conservation-oriented view of the world that has created these dangers for people with cougars.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I learned that was hard to accept at first, the fact that the environmental perspective has its dangers. One thing that we see now is that people like to have wildlife in their backyards. You see, people living in suburban areas who are very pleased if they see a deer walk through their backyard. It's, you know, they're enchanted with the beauty of that animal. Unfortunately, that also means that some of those big animals are less afraid of us than they used to be. And that means that, for example, in the case of a predator like the cougar, it may be more likely to take human prey than it used to be.
And you also write about the fact that cougar culture at one point, older cougars would have taught younger cougars that humans are dangerous and they'll shoot guns at you if you get close to them. So you don't want to get close to them.
Yeah, this is, you know, the advantage of being environmentally irresponsible and shooting things you don't like. The advantage is that it works. It makes those animals who are not shot learn that human beings are dangerous, and it makes them learn to keep their distance. So we see with coyotes, for example, in still in rural areas, tend to be very afraid of humans. They tend not to bother humans. And so in rural Oklahoma, where I grew up, if a coyote were even seen in the daytime, that was fairly unusual because they were aware that humans were a danger to them. But then we see the same animal, the exact same subspecies of animal, in urban areas like in Los Angeles, actually coming into yards, taking pets, and in a couple of rare cases, even attacking children, because they're not used to being shot at. They have a different culture than the same animal in a different place.
And to be clear, you're not advocating that we go around shooting at animals. You're pointing out that this has changed our culture and theirs.
Yeah, and I should, just to keep things in perspective, I should say that the number of people killed by cougars, for example, is still under 100 in recorded history. It's not as if this is a plague of things that we need to have a public policy change to take care of. It's just an interesting fact about animal behavior. It is tragic for a very few people, and yet, you know, it leaves us sort of in the dark about how the bigger question of how these animals should be managed.
Well, and it really calls into question our sort of naivete when we think about all animals as just being beautiful and warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, and again, this is, I think, a side effect of the environmental movement. We've learned that, you know, to reject the earlier model where some animals who were, for example, predators were seen as rapacious and greedy and evil and so forth, and that's just silly, of course, but we've, in a lot of cases, replace that with an equally silly idea that the animals are these majestic symbols of the wild that are there for us to enjoy. And they're not. They're there for themselves. They're not. They don't have anything to do with us as far as their whatever larger meaning they may have.
And we will talk about more creatures in just a moment. My guest is Gordon Grice. He's author of Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Suppose we'll meet any wild animals?
We might. Animals that eat straw? Some, but mostly lions and tigers and bears.
Lions?
And tigers?
And bears.
Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Gordon Grice, author of Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals. In the book, he focuses on the predatory nature of all kinds of animals. We've been talking about canines, wolves, dogs, and dingoes, and we have many other kinds of creatures to talk about. He talks about, in the book, situations where animals hurt or even kill human beings, and he explores why that may happen and what we can learn about these creatures, what we can learn about ourselves from those incidents. Let's talk about cats, because Gordon, there have been many, many times I have a number of cats living in my home, and I love my cats very much, but there have been many times when I've thought, I'm so glad you're not the size of a tiger. and cats are really pure cane or pure carnivores.
Right. Among the group of mammals that are called the carnivores or carnivorids, the cats are the purest. That means they eat the least vegetable matter and the most meat.
So you write a lot about Africa and parts of Asia where tigers and lions live amongst people and really do prey on human beings.
Yeah, this is another thing that's sort of you know, the focus has been taken off it. But it's never ceased to be the case that leopards, tigers, and lions all can prey on human beings. It's not a majority behavior for any of those animals, but it is, on the other hand, not too terribly uncommon.
And tigers seem to be the ones that engage in that behavior the most. Is that accurate?
I think probably proportionally that's the case. In other words, there aren't that many tigers, but of the ones that there are, they're the most likely to hurt people.
Can you give me an example of some of the situations that have been cataloged in recent years where tigers have taken people?
One famous case is in a swamp area called the Sundarbans, which is partly in Bangladesh and partly in India. And the situation there is this, it's a mangrove swamp. In other words, a very wet area. And this seems to be the prime way that a cat would attack a human being, is to be completely in cover. So a cat tends to be less interested in attacking a human being who can see it, who can look at it. And in fact, one of the protective measures that people have taken there is to wear masks with wide open eyes on the backs of their heads, because the tiger is a little bit leery of taking people in that situation. Even so, though, a lot of people who go into that area to collect honeycomb, for example, are simply eaten by tigers. And even people who are on boats in the Sundarbans will sometimes be taken by tigers that have swum out to the boat to take them.
Of course, these are areas where there is continuing pressure on these species. It's not like in the United States, where many species, like the cougars, were almost hunted out of existence and have made a comeback. I mean, there's still a lot of pressure on these predatory species, isn't there?
There is. The situation in India, for example, is interesting because they are protected by the government. And in fact, even that policy can sometimes cause problems because local villagers have to go through this immense bureaucracy to have a leopard or a tiger that's preying on human beings removed or killed even. And so you'll see man-eating tigers and leopards actually take many people before a solution is found.
What do you think we can take away from the fact that there really is a predator-prey relationship? I mean, not on a large scale, but with these creatures, clearly there are some that believe that humans are their prey and behave that way.
For me, it's a lesson in humility. We'd like to think that we're beyond that sort of thing, but we aren't. And we see this across the globe with different animals, that human beings are just as good to eat as many other animals.
I'd like for you to read a little bit of your chapter where you start writing about tigers, if you will.
Okay. "Do you know anyone killed by a tiger?" I said. I had to be blunt because we had little language in common. The man looked hard at me. His short, calloused fingers stopped in the middle of turning a page. I was afraid I'd offended him, but in fact, I had only startled him. It had never occurred to him that I might not know anyone who'd been killed by a tiger. Then he named a few people in their villages. In my job of teaching English to Vietnamese refugees in America, this sort of conversation turned out to be a great tool. Everybody could understand the idea of a tiger from a mere picture, and conversation blossomed from that starting point. Over the years, I heard a number of stories about neighbors eaten by tigers. It was especially in their journeys to escape the country that people learned to fear the tiger. In the jungle, without shelter or weapons, that danger was palpable. Hmong refugees attempting to escape to Thailand often avoided roads and the human dangers associated with them. Their alternative was wildlife trails, where the tigers could take a person unheard." More?
I think that gives us a taste of it.
Okay.
That's Gordon Grice reading from his book Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals. When you talk to the people who lived in that kind of climate, do you find that they have, you know, we in the United States believe that humans are at the top of the food chain. Do you find that people just have a different way of thinking about human beings?
I found that human presumption was kind of constant across the globe. And for example, in some of those scenarios, you would find sort of supernatural beliefs about tigers or about whatever the predator in question was, which seemed to me very similar to the beliefs that I would encounter in the U.S. when, you know, for example, the belief that a wild animal would never hurt a human being unless the human being had provoked it somehow. So I really never found, you know, a good understanding of the predator-prey relationship anywhere I went. And that was sort of one of the things that intrigued me to write about.
Yeah, that is fascinating. You would think that in a place where people are so much more vulnerable, there would be a different idea.
One thing I learned in that situation and in many others was that the vulnerability to animals is always subsidiary. In other words, it's very what happened to the people there at the claws of tigers was a very minor horror compared to what was happening to them because of the war that was going on. And that turns out to be a very consistent scenario across the globe. We're always in more danger from predators when we're in a famine or a plague or a war. It's always the human situation that's the primary horror.
I'm talking with Gordon Grice. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you've ever had a close encounter with an animal that seemed to be dangerous to you, you can tell us your story. Or if you have some thoughts about how humans view themselves in the world that you'd like to share, any questions for Gordon, give us a call at 866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to talk now about sharks, because I think that sharks are one of those species that people do view as dangerous. And certainly we like to watch Shark Week on the Discover Channel. And when there's a shark attack, people certainly become very aware of it. It makes a lot of news. But how dangerous are sharks to people?
The danger from sharks is minuscule. They compared to the, for example, the number of incidents of people being in the water, the incidence of any of them being attacked by a shark, even in a minor way, is minuscule. And it's a strange thing about us that, for example, traffic is not terrifying to most of us. Traffic is far more dangerous than sharks ever are. And yet the shark is the one that makes the great horror story. It's, the Jaws principle. That somehow that's so terrifying, even though it's really unlikely that would ever happen to you, even if you purposely jumped into the sea with a great white nearby.
You do write that people who swim with dogs in the ocean seem to be at a slightly higher risk of shark attack.
Dogs, because of their particular way of moving in the water, they make a lot of noise and they splash a lot. They look like some sort of sea life in distress, and that to a shark is a flashing banner that says there's food here.
So even the shark that inspired the story of Jaws, I guess the first man that he attacked had a dog with him, right?
He did, yes. This was the New Jersey attacks of 1916, where we don't even know if it was really one shark, but there were a couple of people who were killed at the shore, and then there was also a shark that went up a river there, or a creek, injured some more people. So it may all have been one shark, and it was certainly that theory was what inspired Peter Benchley to write Jaws.
As much attention as any shark attack that takes place now gets, you also write about a time when shark attacks did not get much attention, and that was in World War II, when the government actually suppressed stories of shark attacks.
They did. The theory was that it would ruin morale and hurt the war effort if people knew how horrifying it really was to be on a ship that was sunk in the Pacific. And so the fact is that at places like Guadalcanal, when ships were sunk, sharks were a major factor in killing the sailors who went into the water.
You tell some pretty gruesome stories about that.
Yeah, the famous one that, at least the most gruesome one, is the USS Indianapolis. This is the ship that had delivered components for the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And because that was a secret mission, there was sort of a bureaucratic tangle, and once the ship happened to be sunk by a Japanese torpedo, no help was sent for it. And so the men were in the water, the men who survived the initial sinking were in the water for almost 5 days, And we think that at least a couple hundred of them were killed by sharks.
Wow. That's so amazing to think about. And you talked about how a shark would pull from below and a man would go under and then his life jacket would just come up a few minutes later.
Yeah, amazing anecdotes from the survivors, and there were some survivors. For example, of a human being's speeding across the surface of the water because there was a shark, you know, attacking them that you couldn't see, but you could see the top of the man speeding across the water.
We have Tom on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I was just wondering, sir, if you had any knowledge of Billy Arjun Singh from India.
I'm not familiar with that.
He was a gentleman who apparently had a tiger or tigress as a pet, kind of a pet. He raised a tigress as a pup with his dog, a German Shepherd. And so the two of them were like brother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time, I mean, they'd walk through the, he had just a small acreage near a forest preserve in India. And they would go for walks. This was on television. It's been quite a few years ago. It was on public TV.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually the tigress, he wanted to let the tigress go. So he went across the river and let the tigress go in a preserve area. And some months later, the tigress reappeared with two kittens of her own and actually let the dog lick them, which was remarkable, I guess, just almost unheard of. But because she and the dog had grown up together, they were like brother and sister. They didn't realize that they weren't of the same species.
And that one is actually the prey of the other in the wild, yeah.
Right, right. But I thought that was just one of the most fascinating things that I'd seen over the years.
Well, and Gordon, you do write about a number of people that keep animals like tigers or lions, large predator animals, as pets. They live quite happily with them. But you also write about the fact that even there are dangers. And people who become very comfortable with an animal, whether they're in a zoo or whether they're a personal pet or whether they're in a circus, that often things can go wrong because people seem to forget that these animals have that wilder nature.
Yeah, there are a lot of scenarios like the one Tom mentioned where, you know, the animal raised from a cub really seems very comfortable around people, and the people oftentimes have no problem with it. But there are those exceptions. And I shouldn't say they're exceptions because actually the big cats, as they near maturity, almost always are not suitable to be around people. One scenario that you see is, for example, when a keeper shows a sign of weakness. To the big predators, that means that he's prey, and the fact that he's also, in some sense, their friend doesn't turn that off. So, for example, if somebody who's been keeping a lion or a tiger as a pet for a long time goes into the cage with a limp, he's got an ingrown toenail that day, suddenly he can be killed by that same animal that he spent years with. The same thing, another trigger is a small animal running. And so, for example, if you bring a child into the vicinity of a lion or a tiger, that can make that animal very quickly reassert its predatory nature.
You also write about a number of incidents where animals at zoos or in circuses injure people who are viewing them because people taunt them. And that's another thing. We feel very safe at a zoo or at a circus, but people can do ridiculous things to these creatures.
Yeah, you may remember a few years ago at Christmas, three young men were attacked by a tiger in a California zoo. And according to some witnesses, at least, those men were taunting the tiger, maybe even throwing things at it. And the keepers of the zoo, of course, thought that this was a safe enclosure they had this tiger in because there was a moat, there was a high wall, and they had never seen a tiger clear that kind of distance. But the new factor there was that this was an angry tiger, and sometimes a tiger that hasn't ever bothered to do that before actually can clear a moat and a high wall. And in this case, that led to the attacks on these three young men. We've seen an almost identical scenario, too, with a gorilla that was teenagers were throwing ice or rocks or something at it in a zoo, and it leapt over a moat, a high wall, and some barbed wire on top of the wall and injured a few people.
Well, and you also write about an elephant where they're not exactly clear on what exactly happened, but someone was offering the elephant a banana and then taking it away repeatedly, and that ended up being a fatal encounter.
Yeah, the elephant, this was in a circus, and the elephant actually went up into the bleachers and gored the young woman who supposedly was taunting it and also injured her family. An elephant is an incredibly intelligent animal, and it really has a bad temper. It doesn't, you know, it understands who's doing what to it, and it's oftentimes willing to take revenge for it.
Well, we will talk more about other kinds of creatures. My guest today is Gordon Grice. He's the author of Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals, and he writes about the predatory nature of many different kinds of creatures and our human relationships with them, what we can learn about these creatures and what we can learn about ourselves from those encounters. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm talking today with Gordon Grice, author of Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals. He writes about all different kinds of animals and their dangerous encounters with human beings. And you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And on Twitter, Jeff said, "Do rattlesnakes and jellyfish count? I've had run-ins with both, although they were in Texas before I moved to Iowa." And you write quite a bit about jellyfish. And, you know, we were talking about sharks a moment ago, but jellyfish in many ways are far more dangerous.
Yeah, some of the most severe toxins that we know about occur in jellyfish. And so you'll see in a few rare cases, people will die within an hour of being stung by jellyfish.
And certainly something that you don't put up as many red flags about when you go into the water.
Yeah, although in Australia, I have to say, they many of the beaches are posted as jellyfish areas, and there are even gallons of vinegar left there for people to use to wash off the stings that they get, because it's such a common problem to have at least minor stings from jellyfish.
Earl is on the line from Cumming. Hello, Earl.
Yes.
Hi, what's your story?
We've got a number of bobcats in our house, or near our house, in the Cumming area. And everybody in the rural area has some story about seeing bobcat families walking around. But 7 years ago, while living in Kansas, my kids came running in and said, "There's a mountain lion in the backyard." And I ran out expecting to see the neighbor's cat. And it was a mountain lion. It was probably 120, 130 pounds. But the thing that was striking is it was closer to my kids than I was. And it occurred to me that if that mountain lion, who seemed very relaxed and not at all agitated, if he had turned and attacked one of the kids, there just wasn't a darn thing I could have done about it. And wondered if there's any strategies for supporting these kinds of animals in the wild but keeping them out of urban areas.
Gordon?
Sadly, there's not a perfect solution to that. And, you know, this is, you know, the ultimate parent's nightmare that makes it very hard to, you know, to support having the wildlife roam free in all cases. The best thing that we can see is the sort of thing that's done in many states where the wildlife department manages these populations, and they actually kill any animal that actually hurts a person or that seems to be habituated to people. In other words, an animal that comes into a backyard is a problem animal. And that's not a great solution. Obviously, it ends up destroying some animals that we'd rather not have destroyed, but seems to be the best way to keep them from hurting people.
If somebody encounters a situation like that, Do you have any advice that you could give them? Like a loud noise might scare a mountain lion away or something along those lines?
It's different for adults and for children. For adults, you want to make yourself the most formidable thing you possibly can, which involves raising your arms. If you have a jacket, you can sort of puff, you know, hold it out to make yourself look bigger. Cats and many other predators are very conscious of the size of their potential prey item or their enemy. And you can also shout and make loud noises however you can. That will oftentimes scare away a mountain lion. For a child, it's not the same advice. Of course, a kid who's seeing something scary, his instinct is to run away, and that's exactly what triggers a mountain lion's chase instinct, is seeing a small animal running. It's like rolling a rubber ball in front of your cat. And so in that situation, if Earl was able to, I would suggest that he tell his child to back slowly away from that animal. Of course, Earl could distract it by making noises or making himself look formidable at the same time.
Right, but obviously in a situation like that, if you can, just go inside and
yes.
Wait it out.
Absolutely.
Earl, thank you so much for your call. And Vajpay is on the line from Cedar Falls. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. What would you like to talk about?
Two and a half things. First, we may humans rules for these big animals move into their habitat, and then we expect that they are so intelligent they should avoid us. One caller talked about Billy Singh in I knew him a little bit. I'm from India, and he was a major tiger conservationist, which I support too through World Wide Fund, and they're a wonderful creature. And one of had found two tiger cubs, kept them for a while. They became too wild. They were go.
Vajpay, you're cutting out on us.
Elephants, yes, they take revenge. My family, at one point, quite a few elephants. And in one incident, one elephant did kill his caretaker because caretaker was cheating on the food. And we cheat, we do bad things to them, and then we expect them to behave like little ladies or little gentlemen. That's not fair.
Vajpay, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to let you go because you're cutting out on us a little bit. But that is interesting. He talks about an elephant taking revenge because its caretaker was cheating it out of food. And you do see incidents of that, not just with elephants, but you also write about that with whales. Whales seemingly taking revenge on ships that were killing other whales.
Yeah, it's with whales especially, it's hard to sort out the folklore from the truth. But it seems as if these are animals that can tell individual human beings apart, and that in the case of whaling vessels, they learned to associate what sort of vessel was the most dangerous to them. This famous whale called Moby Dick, who was this semi-legendary figure that was, of course, Herman Melville's model for Moby Dick. Seems to have had some truth to it. At least some whales were going around sinking ships after having been attacked by whaling vessels.
I want to go back to the caller that we had earlier. He mentioned bobcats in the wild, and bobcats are making a significant comeback in Iowa now. They were nearly gone. And I don't believe you write about bobcats. Do you have any knowledge of bobcats and their interactions with people?
Yeah, there is actually one passage about bobcats in the book. It has to do with a case of a rabid bobcat attacking a person.
Right, okay, I remember that. But that's a very different situation than an unprovoked attack. Rabies can make any animal dangerous.
Yeah, there seem to be basically two situations in which a bobcat will hurt you, and the other one besides rabies is if you on purpose or accidentally seem to be attacking it. So, for example, we have a case of a woman who saw her cat fighting with what she thought was another house cat, and she yelled at the cat to leave her cat alone, and it turned out to be a bobcat, and then it attacked her because her tone was threatening. So they're not timid animals, and they can be dangerous in some situations.
Josh is on the line from Davenport. And Josh, you grew up in Zimbabwe?
Yes, ma'am, I did indeed.
And tell me your story.
my dad and a couple of his friends all decided to take their sons on a trip to the Okavango swamps, and we ended up going for a couple of weeks. But on one of our little excursions with an older boy, my friend Simon and I ended up in a small sort of 12-foot jumbo sort of deal in an area that was cut out by the hippopotami with their they make large lakes within the water system, and then they have small tributary travel areas that they go on. We got too close to a family group. The older boy was kind of showing off a little bit, and one of the males took umbrage to it and chased us for about a quarter mile. It was a fairly terrifying thing to see how quickly they could move, and our little outboard was not making us move as fast as we should have been.
You write about encounters with hippos, Gordon.
Yeah, they're incredibly dangerous animals. You know,
they look so mild.
We think of them as, I think Fantasia is one of the sources of this, you know, comical image that we have of hippos. But some of the big males have tusks 4 feet long. They have been known to literally bite people in half. You see just incredible traumatic injuries from people who accidentally startle hippos at, you know, just walking at night, and the hippo feels threatened because you happen to pass between it and the water. So amazingly dangerous animals, and they do kill quite a few people in Africa.
Josh, thank you so much for sharing your story. And one of the other things that you write about in your book are snakes. And mm-hmm. I found it so interesting. You wrote about so many incidents where pythons that people were keeping as pets have injured them or killed children in the house. And it kind of, I understand that people keep pythons as pets. It just boggles my mind that anybody would keep that large a snake in the house, but they can be very lethal.
They can. I have to say that it's really unusual. We have, maybe a couple of dozen cases of big constricting snakes killing people. And that's compared to thousands and thousands of people who keep them and have no problem. So it's unusual. The thing that probably isn't obvious to most people is that it's great fun to have a big snake around. They're these amazing, unique pets. What I wrote about in the book is the dangerous side. They have, unlike cats and dogs, where we feel like there probably is some kind of emotional relationship with them, perhaps they have some feelings toward us despite miscommunications and so forth. A snake doesn't have that, as far as we can tell. It, if it sees a child and it's hungry, then there's a chance that it'll kill that child.
I loved your line that a disproportionate number of them are named Monty.
Yes.
The pythons that are kept in captivity. But that does bring me to a very interesting question, and that is, you have studied all of these creatures, you've looked at all of these worst-case scenarios, and it doesn't... I am an animal lover. I feel very comfortable around animals, but reading this book doesn't make me feel more comfortable around animals. But in your household, you keep dangerous animals. You have a tarantula. You collect black widow spiders. Why do you do this?
I have to say I don't keep dangerous animals in my house. I keep animals that many people would find creepy, like tarantulas. But
okay.
I've taken care to choose species of tarantulas that are mild-mannered and that don't have a significant venom for human beings. And I did in the past keep black widow spiders, but having children changed that for me.
All right. But what do you think we should take away from all of these stories? And you know, you write about such a wide array of encounters, some of them purely accidental, some of them where animals were taunted, some of them where a wild animal kept as a pet has turned on their owner. What should we take away from all of these different experiences?
For me, there are two things. One is respect for the animal in its own terms. Not whether it's good or bad for us, but trying to understand what the animal's behavior is really like, trying to look at the biology and seeing why does the animal do what it does. And the other thing for me is just the beauty that's inherent in all this diversity. Even though this book looks at the kinds of animal behavior that can hurt us. To me, it's just a fascinating array of behaviors and tools that animals have.
Clearly, that's how you feel about it. But I know that a lot of people who are fascinated with, you know, the shows of when animals attack or Shark Week or things like that don't have that relationship with nature. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned at all that you're going to encourage people to take a more violent or a view of nature?
I'm not concerned about me because I think this book, for example, takes pains to show what circumstances cause the problems. And in almost every case, I pointed out how rare those situations are. I am more concerned about sensationalistic TV that gives you no science and gives you no context for the attacks that you witness.
You end the book with a look at primates, with some of the dangers that people can encounter with monkeys or chimpanzees or gorillas. But you end with human beings as the primate that is most dangerous of all. Mm-hmm. What do you want us to take away from that?
I think if there's any one thing to take away from it, it's a message about overpopulation more than anything else. That's the greatest danger to us, is the fact that there's too many of us for the resources we have. And that's not as dramatic of a story to read about. It's a very familiar message. But ultimately, the many ways that we hurt each other are far more significant than what all the other animals do put together.
When you read these stories, and, you know, I'm someone who likes to camp and likes to hike and likes to go on adventures, it does, focusing on the negative things that happen to people in the wilderness, that has the effect of making you feel more nervous when you think about that, especially as a parent. What do you want people to take away?
I think when, for example, in enjoying the wild, which I do a lot myself, the key is education. And that involves looking at the specific place where you are, learning what the wildlife is like in that area, and learning what the specific steps are to take with that. For example, if you're going to hike in grizzly bear country, knowing how to respond in case the worst case scenario happens. And if you do that, then I don't think there's any reason for fear. You take the reasonable precautions, and then you enjoy the planet that we have, and you simply respect the wildlife that's there.
You will be reading tonight in Iowa City at Prairie Lights at 7 o'clock. As your book goes out into the world and you talk to different people as you do readings, what kinds of questions are you getting most of the time?
I get an amazing array of responses. Some people are, I think, are sort of offended at the idea that that animals could do something bad to us. A lot of times people have been told that the animal only does something bad if the person forced it to. And so that's a little bit of resistance that I get. Other people are really interested to hear about some odd animal that I mentioned that they've never heard of before, but maybe they've had an encounter. Maybe they've never had it mentioned in public before, that this is an animal to be treated with care.
And what is your ultimate hope that people will learn from this?
I think the beauty of it all, amazingly dangerous as some animals can be, I'd like us to appreciate the beauty of them at the same time.
Gordon, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Gordon Grice is the author of Deadly Kingdom, the Book of Dangerous Animals. He lives in Wisconsin, and he'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 o'clock. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. It's produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. You can hear the program online anytime at iowapublicradio.org, or send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe.